Where's Miriam? Oh, Miriam. That gives me so much hope. I also worked in the school system, and you know, to hear this sort of practice being taken into the school just makes me feel that a new future is possible. You know, so thank you so much for letting us know that. And it's really nice to hear. I know about the mindfulness within the health system. Where's Claire? Claire's not here. Oh, there's Claire. Yes, I know that the mindfulness within the health system is making, you know, really significant inroads. So it's wonderful to hear how these practices are going mainstream. Certainly, it feels like our world really, really needs them. As Kate mentioned, this is the final session of this seminar on practicing with the world, cultivating engaged activity. I had really wanted to use this theme of how do you unite your spiritual practice with what you're doing in the world, because as Miriam pointed out, this has sort of been my theme all my life, as far as I can tell, even back to childhood. These thoughts were really, really strong in me. And so I'm very grateful that I've had this opportunity to really immerse myself in this. And I'm very grateful that all of you have been part of this journey. The Buddha was a realist, as far as I can tell. He was also a social reformer, as have been most great spiritual leaders. And in the Four Noble Truths, he talked about suffering, how to be aware of your suffering, what was the cause of suffering, how to be aware of the suffering. And then the Fourth Noble Truth really is the action plan for how to deal with this, how to transform your life. And it's interesting that a number of the steps in the path are about sila, about engaged activity. It's about your thoughts, your speech, your actions, your efforts, your livelihood. All of these things talk about how do we want to take this energy into the world. And it's about how do we create a base of ethical activity that allows us then to engage in the world in a way that that really helps to enliven those thoughts. And in turn, how does our experience in the world come back to us as sort of the ground in which we get to practice these things, and how does that then impact our practice itself? In exploring this issue of how to apply our practice in the world and what the world can teach us for our practice, I've come to realize, I've noticed how really deeply important it is, not just to me, but just about everybody I know. And the other thing that I notice is that people are often really, really critical of themselves. They set a standard that is often unachievable, that I will always be honest, I will always be kind, I will always be compassionate, and then end up feeling like they are really lacking. They really aren't, you know, fulfilling what their intention is. So today we're actually going to talk about the Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva is often, I find, put out in sort of ideal terms. The person who has realized the unity in the universe, and that now can go and work from that, can go and engage from that perspective, and that coming from this sort of purified or rarefied experience, they can now devote their energy to all beings and the well-being of everyone. And while I think that that is very much an inspiration, I find it sometimes really difficult to put myself in that place, because I don't feel that I have come to this great realization. I'm very aware of my imperfections, and if I somehow have to have obtained that, then you know, where do I go with that? I don't believe that that is the lesson that we are being given. The Bodhisattva vows that beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. These are absolutes. They are directional cues. They are not goals that we can attain. They are inspirations that can help to direct our energy. And then we have to get down into the trenches and deal with this human life and with our imperfect nature. And what is it that we can actually do? How, keeping that inspiration in our mind, how do we then work with the energy that is in the world? You know, I'm noticing I'm not following my notes at all. So, we're going to skip right on to. Often what we have to learn to work with is our afflictions or our hindrances, the things that we feel are imperfect about us. It's very much like conflict. It's the place where you get to learn, but often is not what you're most comfortable with. It's the thing that you would often like to put aside. Thich Nhat Hanh, in a book he wrote called Understanding the Mind, which is 50 verses of mindfulness, and it's based on both the Abhidharma and the Mahayana traditions. And on the 50th verse, it's the culmination, and it's titled No Fear. When we realize that afflictions are no other than enlightenment, we can ride the waves of birth and death in peace. Traveling in the boat of compassion on the ocean of delusion, smiling the smile of no fear. When I first encountered this, I found this so liberating that I actually sort of made a little jingle up and I would sing it to myself. This idea that our afflictions are actually the path. They are the very thing that will actually open us up to realization. Our hindrances. So what's important about our hindrances or our afflictions is learning how to work with them, not to use them as some sort of a stick to beat ourselves up with, but as a connection with all the beings in this world that are just like us, that are just putting in their best effort and often not succeeding. Riding the waves of birth and death in peace, in a world of constant change, bodhisattvas are still able to smile with compassion and fearlessness, because they see that afflictions and awakening are two sides of the same coin. They are complementary energies. Traveling in a boat of compassion on the ocean of delusion. We are passing through this world of delusion, but we are sustained by compassion. Smiling the smile of non-fear. Non-fear is the greatest gift that we can offer others and ourselves. Our spiritual practice helps us to see our true mind. We don't need to run away from our afflictions or go somewhere else to attain enlightenment. We are no longer afraid of birth and death because we have touched our true nature. On the way over here today, or not, it was yesterday, I was down in the bowels of the ferry waiting to get off. The ferry is a very close timing for the bus that only goes once an hour, and there was another person standing beside me, and we were both getting ready to run. And we started a conversation about, you know, would the bus wait? And I saw he had a suitcase, and so I asked him, I said, are you coming from somewhere else? And he said, yes, I'm coming from Galliano, but I live in Switzerland. And I said, whoa, that's a long commute. And he said, well, Galliano has been a part of his past, and he's always been, it draws him. So we went on to talk, and I guess I asked him what he did in Switzerland, and he said, well, I work for the UN. He said, I work in the fund that deals with AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. And then he said, you might know who I am. I'm Sven Robinson. I'll go back, because probably not everybody here knows who Sven Robinson is. Well, Sven Robinson was the youngest MP ever elected. He was 26 years old. He was just minted out of law school. He was also the first member, and he was from Vancouver, Vancouver East, I think. He was also the first member of parliament that came out as openly homosexual. He was very much of an idealist, quite controversial at times. And I had actually worked with him on different committees over the years, and I greatly admired his energy. He really did seem to be somebody who was really fighting the good fight. And then when he was maybe early 50s, he did something that was completely incongruous with his life. He stole a diamond ring. And he did it in a place where he was absolutely bound to be caught. And he at the time, he said he had gone through a trauma where he had fallen in the wilderness and had to sort of crawl home. And he said that trauma was part of the reason that he had done this. It ended his political career. And I often wondered sort of what had happened to him afterwards. I had heard that immediately afterwards he had gone into doing some therapy. So to meet him on the ferry and find out how he had been really using his energy now with the UN, and he said it gives him a great opportunity to use, he's doing their political work, and it gives him a great opportunity to use his experience. And I just thought about how, okay, so here's this human being, you know, who has been really devoting their life to, you know, to doing the things that are really, were really, you know, worth doing. And he had come upon his own place, his own brokenness. And it had stopped him for a while, but that I didn't have a chance to find out. You know, I did mention to him that I was, you know, I knew him from before, and I didn't have a chance to find out about that experience. It would be interesting to know. But the hopefulness of getting back there and engaging again was what really I came away from that with. And so that it hadn't defeated him. My guess is that it has enriched his life. I think because most of the people who want to really sort of dedicate their life to trying to help with the well-being of others, mostly that's people who are sensitive, emotionally sensitive, usually fairly intelligent, and as I said, often quite critical of themselves. And I think sometimes we can take a sort of overly pessimistic view of life from that. And I think keeping in mind the perspective that this energy that seeks the enlightenment of all beings, that seeks well-being, isn't something that we possess. It is the nature of our world. It is the nature of our universe, that in the Lotus Sutra, it's all about how the whole universe is there to assist us to wake up. And so I wanted to also talk about sort of some examples in the world where things are going what you might call irrationally well. or what I call sort of irrational optimism. A book I read recently is Steven Pinker's Angels of Our Better Nature. Has anybody here read this book?
No, just the reviews.
Mm-hmm. It's a difficult book to read. It's on the nature of the history of violence within the human race. And that is a subject I have a lot of trouble with. I can't watch movies that are violent, you know, so to actually read this book was challenging. And I can't honestly even claim I read all of the book. But I did read enough of the book to understand, it's 700 pages long, understand the sort of message that the human race by all indicators, whether it be relationships, laws, wars, is becoming a more peaceful society. This may fly in the face of what you see on the evening news or what's happening in the American election or all of these things, but starting back from the one thing that they have actually been able to judge or guide or understand is murder, whether somebody has come to a violent death. In the prehistoric men, they can tell by what sort of damages there's been to the body. And they figure in the prehistoric time about 25% of people actually came to a violent end. So this idea that we have of this sort of peaceful state that we may have risen from is actually quite erroneous. And when they look around at people who are living in what you might call Stone Age culture now, they find this is really true, that it is actually very violent. That our laws, our human rights codes, these have actually all come out of this need for us to be more peaceful. So one of the things he does in his book is that he graduated in the mid-1970s, and he poses this idea that if you looked over the next 35 years, in mid-1970s, if you had made a guess about some of the things that would come to pass you would be amazed. So in that 35 years, nuclear weapons have not been used again against civilian populations. The Soviet Union declared peace with the West, and the Cold War was over without a shot. East Germany's borders were opened, and the students joyfully sledgehammered the Berlin Wall to smithereens. South Africa, the apartheid regime was dismantled, and the white minority seceded power to the black majority. This happened with no civil war, no blood bath, no violent recriminations. I know leading up to it, because I was quite involved in it, that there was, of course, a great deal of struggle and tumult. But when it actually came to the transfer of power, there wasn't. And this was a great surprise. People figured, you know, when it finally blows, it's going to be horrible. But it wasn't. And in South Africa, well, even before South Africa, a new form of seeking justice was begun, and that's the Truth and Reconciliation Councils. That now, no longer what they seek to do, rather than finding fault with whoever, you know, with the abuses of the people who are no longer in power, they now to unite the community again by allowing the victims an opportunity to talk about what's actually happened to them without there being criminal consequences to the people who have done it. And this is an amazing change. And in Canada, we've also been going through our own truth and reconciliation with the natives. That started in 2006. And what this does, instead of pitting one group against another, it opens the dialogue up between the two groups. So I guess what I'm saying in this is that there's a lot of That does not mean that we turn our attention away from what is actually, you know, what is actually going on in the world, the difficulties. It means to approach it with a softer heart, with more trust that things can resolve themselves, or that we're going in the direction of a more caring and compassionate world. A book that I read recently is Joanna Macy's Act of Hope. Joanna Macy is an interesting woman. She is a devout Buddhist. She is a systems analyst, and she has been active in the world for most of her life, and she is now in her mid-80s. And the subtitle of this book was How to Stay Sane in a Crazy World. But she's talking very much about how do we engage from coming from that deeper sense of truth. And she talks about steps along the path to doing this. The first one is to take a clear view of reality. Simply believing that things are getting better does not absolve anybody from the reality of from the necessity of actually looking at how things are. It's like looking at the suffering. The second step is to pause and step into uncertainty, to engage the not knowing mind. Open up to the possibilities that there are different ways of going about this, rather than going down the line that, you know, okay, this is bad and it's getting worse, and these are the reasons why it's getting worse. And then the third one is the one that I find really interesting. It's about setting intention and having vision. Identify a direction you would like to move towards, a value you would like to express. Intention is something that I've heard expressed as that it's like a fishing hook, and that you throw an intention out and then you reel yourself in. Intention doesn't mean you have to, it's not a goal that you're trying to reach. It's more like an aspiration. It is the way you want to go, and you may actually not have any idea how you will get there. And then the fourth step is to engage, to take steps to move yourself in that direction. So having set an intention, then you need to bring it back to something practical, something discernible, one small thing you can do in your life towards that. She talks about when we're looking at the world, it's sort of, we need to go back and look at the story we're telling ourselves. And because it's from that story that we will act. So the stories in our world, the one is what's called business as usual. Everything is basically okay, that I'm doing okay, and that if there are problems, science will solve it, or what's the other one? Or market forces. Clearly, I am blanking. and I'm sure we've all seen this one. So that is really, in that mental set, there is really an avoidance that there's anything that needs to be looked at. So the second one is that it's catastrophe, it's doom and gloom. And in this one, there is a great attention to what is the problem. And usually learning a lot about it and sort of focusing on it. And I think this is the camp that, you know, I have spent a lot of my life in. I've learned a lot about, you know, what's going wrong. And it's that's part of the clear view. It's really important to have a clear sense that of what is actually happening. But if you stop there, one, it's very discouraging. Two, it really doesn't allow for the fact that there's many things that work in this world, and you know you're only just a very small part of it. The other problem is, and this is something I've seen in a lot of the sort of social justice work that I've had, is that people turn off. People don't actually want to listen if all they hear is doom and gloom. My daughter was, when she was in McGill, she was going to study environmental sciences, and she said, no, I'm not going to do that. She said, they're all depressed. the uplifting part actually needs to be there. It needs to be there. And I think particularly when you're working with children and that sort of thing, that I think children are one of the things that give you that uplift, you know. And then she said the third one, which is the new day, and it's the vision without goals. The willingness to try and engage your energy, being aware of the problem, but also trying to be open to a vision that is of a world that you would want to see. You know? So that's what I want to actually focus our last little part together on. One of the things Johanna Macy, she's at the very end of this book, she does the Bodhisattva's perspective. If a Bodhisattva is taking a vow from, well, as a Bodhisattva, you do take the vow, especially in Jukai, you take the formal vow that for all of eternity, you will contribute your energy, you will put your energy towards the well-being of everyone, of everything. And that even if you're able to find your own sort of personal nirvana, which is actually not possible, but that you would still turn back towards assisting everyone. Well, if we take that vow now, perhaps we've taken that vow throughout eternity. Perhaps the life that we are living right now is actually the embodiment of that vow. Perhaps we are just once again on the wheel, contributing our energy how we will. And if you think of it from that direction, that means that everything in your life is the perfect place to practice because you've chosen this. She suggests an exercise where we think like 35 years into the future. Put yourself 35 years into the future. What is the vision that you would want to see then? What intention could you have right now to help move yourself and the world towards that vision? And what's something very specific that maybe you could do in this moment? So this is the exercise that I want to try. So I'm going to ask, we're going to actually give you a chance, so I'll remind you, we'll pass out the papers and pens, one on each direction. You know what? These do get turned on.